National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start this month with a visit to one of two paintings in the National Gallery's collection by the French 19th century artist Jean-François Millet. Born into a peasant community in a small Normandy village, Millet is best known for his realistic depictions of rural life. Art historian Jackie Ansell introduced me to The Winnower, a striking portrait of a peasant farmer at work in a barn.
You're drawn in by the light that diffuses its way through the painting. It's almost Rembrandtesque, actually. He emerges from the darkness. And if you think about it, there are very few working-class people at all depicted in the gallery. And he's not just a worker. He's somebody who's visibly working before your eyes. He's winnowing. He's separating the wheat from the chaff. The light is shining on the back of his neck, which gives you the sense of the strain as he's heaving that great big winnowing basket up onto his knee. And if you look down towards his feet, you'll see they're rooted very firmly into his sabots, these peasant wooden shoes, and he's tried to make them a bit more comfortable by stuffing them full of straw. So there's all these little details. And if you look back at the knee pads, they're actually pieces of cloth fastened on by bits of straw that have been woven around to make rope. So it's a very sort of simple painting, and it shows actions that anybody really who lived in the countryside would be really familiar with. And that's why I think it needs a bit of explanation today, because we haven't really seen those activities played out before our eyes.
As you say, it's a far cry from the sort of very prim and pampered images of aristocrats with beautifully embroidered clothing, sitting very still or perhaps making a stylish gesture.
Absolutely. I'd just like to read you an extract from Gautier's Salon Review, because this was a painting that was exhibited in 1848 in the French Salon. And he says, "The winnower rises to his feet in a masterly way, lifting his winnow from his shabby knees. The powdery effect of the grain spreading through the air could not have been portrayed better. And this scene makes you want to sneeze."
It does look as though it could give you an allergy, doesn't it?
It does, really.
The focal point of the painting really seems to be his hand gripping the side of the winnowing fan. And it's so strong and muscular. You can almost see why perhaps that might have alarmed people.
Yes, if you think about descriptions of workers generally in novels of the time as hands, and the idea, of course, that a hand that now grips a plough, if you like, could soon hold a weapon, action à la rue, where you pick up the cobblestones and throw them at people, is something that would very clearly be in the minds of the contemporary observers, I think, you know, with the 1830 revolution and the 1848 revolution.
There's also not very much colour in the painting, is there, apart from the red hat that he's wearing?
Yes, and the red hat's significant, of course, because it reminds you of the Phrygian slave, the cap of liberty that was used as a potent symbol in the 1789 revolution.
And there's a tail, isn't there, that hangs upon his shoes, which are these wooden clogs.
Yes, I suppose so. You know, the idea that they're sabots, these wooden clogs, and the term sabotage, the idea of workers horrified at the machinery that was taking away their work, sticking their sabot into the machinery. So certainly I think there are various ways in which the public would be shocked by it, not least, in fact, the way in which it's painted. Because one thing that you could pick up on from the idea of making you sneeze when you look at the painting is the dryness of the paint. And Gautier talked about this in his description. He said, "On dishcloth material, without oil, paint or turpentine, he applies with a trowel a brickwork of colours which soaks up all the varnish. Nothing else looks so coarse, wild, spiky and unrefined." I mean, this was an artist who trained under Delaroche, who is, you know, one of the most archetypal academic artists. But now he's hailed as the son of Normandy peasants, who makes the peasant his subject. And I think people can overstate the political implications of that. But certainly, this was a painting that could be seen to horrify the bourgeois on many levels.
Jackie Ansell, talking about Millet's The Winnower, on display in Room 41. Now to Metamorphosis Titian 2012, the gallery's ambitious exhibition and multi-art celebration of three masterpieces by the great 16th century Venetian painter Titian. Over the past few episodes, we've heard how contemporary artists, composers and choreographers have been inspired by the paintings to create a series of stunning new artworks and ballets. This month, the poets get their turn.
Carol Ann Duffy, Seamus Heaney, Simon Armitage, and other leading writers have created poems based on Titian's paintings of the beautiful but terrifying goddess Diana, as portrayed in Ovid's epic Metamorphoses. Diana is bathing naked in a woodland spring when a mortal man, Actaeon, stumbles upon her. In a fury, Diana transforms the young hunter into a stag. He flees, only to be hunted and killed by his own hounds. Gillian Barker, the gallery's Director of Education, Information and Access, explained how the poetry project came about.
When I was thinking about the whole idea of the exhibition Metamorphosis, I was very taken with the way in which Titian himself had looked back at Ovid. So I began to wonder what would happen if we asked some contemporary poets to look back on Titian. And that's how the Titian Poetry Project came about. We decided to invite 14 contemporary poets to respond to the three Diana paintings which were going to be included in the Metamorphosis exhibition. Established voices such as the Nobel Prize winner Seamus Heaney and our poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy, but also some newer voices, people like Patience Agbabi and Frances Leveston. Patience Agbabi took the idea of writing through the voice of the black servant girl who sits behind Diana. So in that case, the poet has taken on one of the characters from the painting and is writing from that perspective.
Actaeon, you'll pay the price for looking like a god, athletic, proud, immortal. Diana, goddess of the hunt, will hound you. She is too harsh. You should have looked at me. I am her shadow, black, yet fairer than the mistress, clad in cloth finer than cirrus. I want you, Actaeon. I wish I were shroud white. Oh, that you'd notice me and mouth each monumental curve. Her handsome face off guard. You brushed aside the drape to see how cool she bathed. With the pool's spray, she cursed you for looking. In this pine-sweet grove, you turned from man to horned and dappled stag, sentenced. Look how your fate reflects itself in water.
You get this whole range of different voices, different ways into the paintings. And possibly one of the most challenging is by Tony Harrison, famous for his drama. Actaeon accidentally stumbled upon this scene and became the voyeur. Tony Harrison challenges us as the reader to question, have we too become the voyeur?
And you, sir. Yes, sir, you who just began to hear these lines, you're maybe a marked man. Haven't you half thought that while you view Actaeon's intrusion, you're intruding too? Perhaps too chubby for most modern tastes, for less ample pulchritude and skinny waist, Diana, scorned by connoisseurs of scrawn, punishes those who'd pimp her as plump pawn.
One of my most amusing moments was walking through the galleries with Seamus Heaney and taking him to see Diana and Callisto for the first time. And he described it as looking at a congregation of limbs, which I just thought was a wonderful way of expressing what you see in the painting. And Seamus himself has taken a very dramatic moment in the story, the moment when Actaeon is hacked to death by his own hounds.
High-burdened brow, the antlers that are stoned, arms that end now in two hardened feet, his nifty haunches, pointed ears, and fleet four-legged run. In the pool he saw a crowned stag's head and heard something that groaned when he tried to speak. Nor was it human sweat that steamed off him. He was like a beast in heat, as if he'd prowled and stalked until he found the grove, the grotto, and the bathing place of the goddess and her nymphs, as if he'd sought that virgin nook deliberately, as if his desires were hounds that had quickened pace on Diana's scent before his own back wrought her vengeance on him at bay beneath the leaf-lit woodland. There his branchy antlers caught when he faced the hounds that couldn't know him as they bayed and fought and tore mouthfuls of hide and flesh and blood out of what he was, while his companions stood impatient for the kill, assessing wounds.
All 14 poems have been published in a rather gorgeous book, which sets the poem against a close-up image that relates to the poet's inspiration.
Thanks to Gillian Barker, Patience Agbabi, Tony Harrison and Seamus Heaney. You can watch the poets reading their work on the gallery's website, www.nationalgallery.org.uk/metamorphosis. And as Gillian mentioned, the project has also generated a book. Metamorphosis, Poems Inspired by Titian, costs £8.99 and is available from the National Gallery and all good bookshops. Look out for the e-book, which will be launched later this month. Finally, there are just a few more weeks to visit the exhibition. Metamorphosis Titian 2012 brings together Titian's masterpieces with new work by contemporary artists Chris Ofili, Conrad Shawcross and Mark Wallinger. The show runs until the 23rd of September and admission is free. And if you're coming along, you might like to know that there's a special offer on the exhibition audio guide. It's 2-for-1 on Tuesdays and Thursdays after 2:30 p.m. Before Hollywood turned Twilight into a mega-grossing vampire franchise, it was a time of day, or perhaps night, that moody moment in between. Art historian Ben Street has made a study of how painters have portrayed dusk over the centuries. He took Cathy Fitzgerald to see two of the gallery's Twilight highlights, beginning with a painting by the 16th century artist Savoldo, which shows St. Jerome kneeling on a rocky outcrop, beating his chest in penitential prayer in front of a crucifix. Ben started by pointing out the figure's luminous backdrop, the sun sinking behind distant hills.
So what we're seeing is a transitional moment, a kind of threshold moment, between two times of day. And what interests me is the way that Savoldo uses that particular kind of time of day to represent or reflect something that's going on within the character. So St. Jerome here is himself at a kind of threshold moment. He's yearning for spiritual succour, let's say, from Christ, but his body is the thing that is chaining him perhaps to the earth.
So the twilight scene becomes symbolic of what's going on for the figure. It's his emotional conflict writ large.
Exactly. I mean, it certainly creates the sense of melancholy mood that you get in the painting, but also, yeah, it's a way of providing an insight into that sense of threshold that's within the character too.
And is the depiction of twilight something that begins to happen at this time?
It's something that we associate particularly with the Venetian Renaissance, with artists like Giorgione and Giovanni Bellini on the cusp of the 16th century, who were interested in using landscape as a way of creating atmosphere or mood, what they refer to as poesia or poetry in painting. What we're talking about is this moment between religious paintings that depict a narrative using figures and paintings that depict a narrative using the whole of the painting. The background is not just a kind of placeholder to tell you, oh, we're in the mountains or we're in the desert. The feeling is in everything. I mean, you don't have to know about the story of St. Jerome to understand this sense of anxiety and melancholy that pervades the painting, because the twilight does a lot of the job. So this is a theme that's very important in 16th century Venetian painting, but it comes back again with particular importance in the Romantic period, and we've got a great example of that in the gallery.
Let's go and have a look.
So, a scene of the end of the day. It's a painting by Turner called The Evening Star, which was painted around 1830. In the foreground, there is a young boy, sketchily painted, quite hard to make out, who is shrimping. His little dog is by his side and he's leaping up. You can see, rising up in the sky, Venus. It's a very mysterious painting. It's very hard to, typically Turner that, very hard to make out that many details in the painting, which I would argue is actually deliberate.
And how does Turner's use of twilight differ to what we saw earlier?
if we think of romantic thought as being a kind of alternative to, a reaction against, enlightenment, rationality and clarity, and empiricism, the theme of Twilight perhaps can be seen as being an assertion of uncertainty, something that Keats described as negative capability, about 10 years before this painting was made. So whereas in the Sevoldo you have a sense that the Twilight setting is providing a kind of extra level of meaning to the narrative, let's say, what Turner does, and his other contemporaries both in writing, philosophy and painting, is that he makes it in and of itself the subject. It's not about a narrative, it's not about shrimping, it's not about Margate, it's about the condition of Twilight. Almost like a celebration of the uncertain, of this time where there's a slight sense of magic in the air, perhaps, where order and logic have gone out of the window, a real assertion of a romantic idea that the liminal moment, this sort of transition or threshold moment between two states, is the time where creativity can really take place. So although it looks indistinct and it looks vague, it is in fact quite a powerful statement in a way about creativity.
Thanks to Ben Street. And you can find Sevoldo's St. Jerome in Room 9 and Turner's Evening Star in Room 34. That's it for this episode. If you're visiting this month, don't forget the National Gallery's open 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays. Until next time, goodbye.